Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, at and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian, The Internet, The Promise, but the Peril, is or soon will be available at the website www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 140th column in the Creative Disruption series. That same issue will also have a column that I did on the Mother Claire Woodley's 25th anniversary as a priest. She is the rector of the St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Mohegan Lake, New York. If the issue containing those is not yet up, the previous issue containing my column, How Books Have Changed with the Technology, will be. So I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if they need be, comment to me at johnmack13.com. And once again, John Mack is JohnMac. JohnMac13@gmail.com. Additionally, I have just begun a daily online newspaper. You don't have to have the site. It's on my web home. Once again, www.johnmac13.com. Check it out and subscribe. It's free, and you only get one email per day. To fund both the radio and the newspaper, both non-revenue producing time eaters, I've set up a GoFundMe site to try to ensure the ongoing sustainability of both. But as yet, the response has been underwhelming. I haven't been really publicizing it, but if you go to my website, you can find out all about it. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. But I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest next week will be the author of one of my all-time favorite books, Gwendolyn Wendy Bounds. Wendy is a former columnist and television personality for the Wall Street Journal and is now the senior director of video and television for Consumer Reports. My guest tonight is a dancer, former playmate, actress, physical trainer, divinity school graduate, attorney, educator, and single parent, Renee L.K. Estabrooks. Wow, that's a mouthful. I first met Renee in the local Barnes & Noble, where the cadre of us hang around to work. I get most of my writing done there. And also to research, debate, and solve the world's problems. Renee came over to a table where I was talking to one of my oldest friends, Jim Casey. It turned out that they were teaching colleagues at Marist College, the school at which I've had an off-and-on relationship for almost 30 years. Renee has a fascinating history, which we will explore on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Renee, and welcome to the show.
Hey, John, I'm really glad to be talking to you.
So let's start right at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I was born in Watertown, New York, a stone's throw, as my dad said, from the Canadian border, in a snowstorm. on December 12th. I just had my birthday 2 days ago. And after maybe 2 or 3 years that my folks were bouncing around upstate New York with their friends and family, my dad got a job on Long Island out on the eastern end, and we moved. So I did all of my growing up, up until the age of 17, out on Long Island.
I spent, unfortunately, the number of summers in Watertown, that Camp Drum, New York. You wouldn't remember it, but one of the main things that I remember is during the summer, the mosquitoes there were big enough to carry you away because they'd been feeding on the on reservists all summer. I know you were somewhat of a precocious child who started reading very early. How early and what were you reading?
My memory of the first time I read was in my dad's car as we were driving to do some of the work that he needed to do at, I believe it was a middle school or high school he was teaching at during the summer school. He was retrieving all of his books and his work and his maps and stuff that he used to teach. And I was sitting with him in the front seat of the car, and he had a book box in between us. And I picked up the first book, and it was a collection of Shakespearean plays. And I randomly opened it up, and I started reading it out loud. It was Othello. And I didn't understand what it meant, but the words just sang to me. There was something incredibly special about being able to read the words, hear my voice, and my dad lit up. I was probably 3 and a half or almost 4 years old, and my love for words and language began in earnest and continues to grow every day.
I was reading comic books then, Alley-Oop and the like, not Shakespeare. You also got into ballet at an early age. Tell us a little about that.
I was at a party. I think it was probably out in Patchogue, which is where my dad was teaching. It's a local party, summer party, and I remember it was really fun because there were other children. We were dancing on the big lawn somewhere, and a famous former dancer from the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, Elaine Pilevsky, was at the party, and she approached my parents and said, "You really should give Renee a chance to take some dance classes because she's very musical and I think she might really enjoy it and be good at it." So I did start dancing at 4 and continued up until I was, well, at least 20 or so.
After that, you got into acting and you danced and acted through grammar school and through high school. What do you remember about those years?
I did. It was a lot of fun, always changed. Pretending to be another character and expanding my understanding of how to be a person. And, I loved memorizing scripts. I have a sort of a quirky ability to memorize scripts very quickly. So I was always off book early on in the rehearsal process, which made it fun for me. I could explore the movement on the stage more. I did musicals. I did dramatic theater. I did summer stock. I did off Broadway in New York City, and had a lot of fun, especially through high school, really exploring all different forms of drama and musical theater.
Do you remember any of the plays you did in high school?
Oh, all of them. They haunt me at night. I think one of my favorite ones was I did Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and I played the lead role. I believe her name is Emily, and I had to die. I had to come back as a ghost, so that was a lot of fun to try to portray a dead person. And I played the role of Laura in The Glass Menagerie, which was William's play, and it was very deep. I had to play a crippled girl, and I found that to be physically demanding, but I was told by the folks who saw it that I really was quite convincing. So I think my dance training helped me a lot.
Another coincidence, my son was the narrator in in Our Town in
Our
high school.
Town, huh?
Yeah.
That's a great role.
After high school, you auditioned for and were selected into a very selective dance program that SUNY purchased, where coincidentally another one I teach as an adjunct. But your path to professional dancing was cut short by injury, and your purchase experience did not go as expected. What happened?
Well, I had been taking many, many classes a week, between 7 and 10 classes a week throughout high school. But when I auditioned for and started my my sort of semi-professional training at Purchase, we were dancing from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. every day. And the teachers were all professional teachers from the different famous companies in New York City and in Paris, very demanding. I loved being in the school. I loved the teaching. One teacher in particular, Martha Graham's dance master, mistress, came and taught modern class, Graham classes. I'd never done Graham before, but my body was well suited for it, and I enjoyed it. And she took a special liking to me, which became my undoing, because she pushed me really hard, and at one point she hit me while I was in the middle of a leap, in the middle of the air. When I landed, my ankle rolled, and I heard a sound that you shouldn't hear, and I was out for a couple of months. I couldn't dance. I could barely walk.
You then transferred to Cortland State but did not graduate. What got in the way?
I think life. Life and love and romance and trying to figure out who I was as a person, as a woman. I was reading a lot of Eastern religion and philosophy books. I was spending time out of class. I wasn't in class, and I didn't complete my schooling, my classes there. And I was fairly dejected when I left the school. I decided that academia wasn't for me at that time, and I left in pretty much of a disgrace. I certainly didn't fulfill my obligations to the school as a student, but there were too many things that were getting in the way, and I wanted to experience different parts of life. So I ended up moving into Manhattan, moving to the city.
I thought that you returned home for a while and you worked locally, and then moved to Manhattan, working as a temp, and then you got into some modeling, some acting, and television work. Tell us about that.
My father, in his wisdom, told me when I entered high school that I should take typing classes and stenography or break shorthand classes. And I was a dancer. I had no reason to do that, but I did it anyway, and I'm very glad I did. When I graduated from high school and I went to college and then college didn't work out, I knew I was going to have to work. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I certainly didn't want to work as a waitress, but I could type, and I could type very fast. And at the time, typewriters were still the electric typewriters, and you had to put in, you had to use the whiteout, and it was quite laborious, but I was really good at it, and I started working for temp agencies in Manhattan. So I would spend a week in one company, and then another week in another company, and I bounced all over the city and met hundreds of really interesting professionals in different careers, and certainly learned not only the city, but learned how to move with some sort of grace in the business world.
You mentioned that during that time you also did some modeling, some acting, and television work. How did that happen?
Well, I've been having done so much acting and performing and dancing as a kid and as a teenager, it felt fairly natural for me. So I started doing auditions in the city and was getting parts in different plays or getting, you know, roles on TV, extra roles on soap operas, and started modeling, doing print work. I did some fashion shows. I was a sitting model. I pretty much did whatever sort of came my way. The city was fun and interesting. This is pre-AIDS. There was a sense of turmoil, but controlled chaos, in a sense. The city was changing and growing. I felt all possibility, complete open journeying in the city, and I just fell in love with Manhattan.
You then auditioned for and you were selected to be the Playboy Bunny. What was that like?
Well, at one point, I wanted to have a more steady income, and I wanted to be able to work in a place where I could choose my hours and not have to work a lot of hours and make, you know, fairly good money, which would allow me more time to audition and to do other roles. So I saw a casting call for the Playboy Club, and they were hiring two people. Really tough gig to get because it's a very strong union. Some of the women that had been there had been there for almost 20 years and had raised their families working, serving as bunnies. So sort of on a fluke I went, and I did get chosen. And I worked for about 7 or 8 months at one stint, and then when I returned to the city after being away for a while, I picked up and did another 5 months there, and I really loved my job. It was a lot of fun. The women that I was with were fantastic. We got along great. It was certainly a sisterhood, and the money was pretty fantastic.
I know that you consider yourself a feminist now, feminist including Gloria Steinem, who was also the buddy for a while. Consider that type of work exploitive of women. Did you feel exploited at the time in any way?
No, not at all. In fact, I took a slightly different approach to my work at the club. Lots of the girls there, they're all gorgeous women, just beautiful girls, and they could certainly turn any man's head. And I didn't want to compete with the women who were coming as the dates of the gentlemen who were the gentlemen who were there to be entertained by us, but also be served drinks and food, and they bring their dates. Women were very intimidated when bunnies came to their tables because we were dressed beautifully and provocatively. So I decided to do stand-up comedy at every table and make everybody laugh. The women ended up really liking me, and they were the ones in charge of tipping, not their male dates. And I ended up having a lot of fun and learned some good comic timing and put some funny routines together. It was an interesting, fun approach, and it worked for me.
You also began singing in a local NYC club as well as working at Playboy. Were you hoping for a career as an entertainer?
You know what? I felt like I was already doing the work of the entertainer, and I was doing small roles, and I wanted to have a chance to maybe have my own band. I was singing show tunes, and I was singing some jazz, but my favorite thing to sing was country music, and there was very little in the city. In fact, there are only two places that would hire or even entertain country music singers coming in. But I did pull a little band together. We rehearsed, and then we traveled around New York City and New Jersey and got great feedback. It ended up becoming quite an interesting project for me, and I went to Nashville a couple of years later, about 6 years later, hoping to record and stay there. But New York just had its hooks in me. I just couldn't leave the city. I enjoyed Manhattan too much.
After a short detour also to Florida and return to Playboy work, then move back to Long Island, and you got into physical training work. That's another coincidence. My daughter, the marathon runner and former marketing executive, is the physical trainer. How did you get into that kind of work?
I did have the occasion to go back home and stay with my parents for about half a year while I was in transition and trying to decide what I wanted to do. And I saw that there was an help wanted ad for a local Jack LaLanne. They wanted someone who could do physical fitness training and teach stretching classes. I'd been a dancer and been teaching since I was 13. So I went on the interview and I got hired. Within a few weeks, they were teaching me how to do different machines and lift weights. It was a very rigorous training program. Eventually, they invited me to go to their Long Island flagship company, which was in Rockville Center, and I became a manager there in teaching and training. And one day, the CEO of the company of Jack LaLanne met me there and said, there's a club in New York City. It's our flagship international club. It's called the Vertical Club. I'd like you to come and see if that would be a place that you'd like to work and work as a manager and celebrity workout authority. And I said, sure, I'll come and see. And that ended up being a good fit for me. I really enjoyed the challenge of being in a much more demanding, fast-paced, highly competitive workout scene. I met amazing people, had incredible celebrities as clients, and I started developing my own workout format for my clients. So it was a huge step for me, and I'm so grateful I had the opportunity to do that.
And I know that after you were there, returned to college, attending courses at Hunter, what brought on that move, and how long were you at that club in New York?
When I moved south in Manhattan, I moved to the Village. There was an opening at a place called the Joy Movement, which was the top dance school, people who were training to do Broadway, and they were fitness fanatics, people who were sort of on the cusp of their own stardom, kind of the artistic in-crowd, the folks who were running MTV and some of the local television celebrities. Also a lot of NYU school students, film students, actors. It was definitely a sort of a satellite where folks floated in and out and took classes. I went on auditioned. They asked me if I would teach, and I developed a following there. One of my students was actually an adjunct professor at Hunter College, and we had many interesting conversations. And she said, you know, you should think about going back to school. And I said, well, I don't really need to. I'm, you know, making very good money. I'm training. I'm in the best shape of my life. I have freedom. I come and go. I can travel when I want. I was going to Jamaica every 2 or 3 months for a few days just to relax. And my life felt very comfortable. She said, well, if you ever think about going, I would write a letter of recommendation for you. Well, I told her that I had flunked out of school earlier in my life. I wasn't really considered an academic success. She said, well, I'm sure they would give you a chance. I decided I wanted to work for the Peace Corps at one point, and I actually went down to the Peace Corps office, and I marched in thinking I could pretty much write my own ticket. I had a language. I could speak Spanish, and I thought, well, maybe I could get a job in a South American country or maybe Central American company. And they said, well, you sound like a perfect candidate. Where did you do your bachelor's degree? And I said, I haven't finished college. And they said, well, we only take people with 4-year degrees. And I was crushed. I was crushed. I said, oh, my goodness, I'm volunteering to sleep in mud huts, but you're not going to take me because I don't have a bachelor's. But it made me think, and I thought, maybe what I need to do is take my students' advice and try and finish my undergraduate. So I approached Hunter College, and they allowed me to come and take classes. I was on probation, academic probation. They said you have to keep a certain grade point average, and I was very nervous. But 3 years later, I ended up graduating second in my class as the salutatorian, and Harvard Divinity School and Harvard University ended up paying a big chunk of my education because of my grades.
After Hunter, as you just mentioned, you know, to Harvard Divinity School, that sounds like another incongruous move. Playboy Bunny goes to Divinity School. What brought on that move?
Well, while I was at Hunter College, I was studying religions, world religions, ethics. I wanted to know why people did what they did. I had great respect for my friends who were historians and my other friends who were scientists and mathematicians. What really inspired me was to try to figure out why people made the choices that they did in their life. So I studied religion, world religions, language, and I found out that Harvard had a program in ethics. And it was a sort of a wide open program where I could take classes in the other schools at Harvard. I could basically create my own program. So while I was at Harvard, I took classes at the Harvard Law School. I took Chinese law. I took classes at the JFK School of Government. I was one of only 2 women in a class on war and justice. I took classes at the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and at the Ed School. So I created a program on world religions and ethics, gender law, in preparation to go to law school, because I really had it in my mind that I might be a good lawyer, especially someone who helped women and children who were struggling.
Yeah, after obtaining this master's of theological studies, you went off to Fordham Law School, and I know that you had told me that you had hoped to get into one of the local DA's office for special victims work, and I know that you were very happy with both your internships at Fordham. Tell us about those.
My first summer, after my first year of law school, I was lucky enough to land a clerk job for Carol Berkman. She's a sitting Supreme Court judge in New York City. She handled all high crimes, high felonies. She had been one of six women who graduated from her law school class at Harvard. Amazingly smart woman, tough as nails. Both prosecutors and defense attorneys quaked in their boots when they entered her courtroom because she was exacting with everyone and expected people to come well prepared. She hired me to clerk for her for that my first summer, and invited me to sit with her on the bench during some of the city's most famous and notorious trials of very horrific high crimes. And I got to see from her perspective what happened, the whole process of the trial and the defense, voir dire, choosing and selecting juries. It gave me a real insight into the criminal justice system. I'm incredibly grateful to Judge Berkman for hiring me that summer. It was certainly a highlight of my law school time. When I was a second year at Fordham, my ethics professor at Fordham had a friend who was running the Special Victims Unit in Queens, Marjorie Fisher, and he called and asked Marjorie if she would meet with me, and I did, and it was a good fit, and I was hired as her special assistant, and I did research for her on some of the more difficult cases in special victims. I spent a year in the office and was told that I would be offered an ADA ship should I want to be an ADA once I graduated from law school. One thing I learned having spent a year there was that I was really best suited to helping the survivors when they came in, but in the office, ADAs were really very limited in their scope of influence and help for the victims who were coming in. They did a basic intake or interview, but they never really got a chance to help the folks who were coming in. And I love and respect my friends who are ADAs. I know how hard they work, and it's certainly lots of guts and not so much glory. But I knew that I think my skill sets were better suited to teaching or doing counseling work. So I did not take the job.
Although that you had talked about working with battered women, exploited women, your life took another turn when you moved to Hawaii with your soon-to-be husband. You got married, then you had a son. Your 4 years in Hawaii were quite different from your years in New York area. Did much of a culture shock?
Well, we were there for a little over 5 years, and the first year was a tremendous culture shock for me. But I had been studying about Hawaii and the language since I was very young. My family laughed, remembering that when I was 10 or 11, I had posters of Hawaii all over my room. I kept telling them that I would get there someday, and sure enough, I ended up there for 5 years. It was a beautiful place, just extraordinary, just magisterial beauty. Nothing that you could see in a picture would even come close to the experience of the islands. All the islands were different. I got to visit many of them, lived on two of them. My son was born in the islands, meaning that he's a kama'aina, sort of a special dispensation. And I had made many close friends. And it was sad when we chose to leave the islands in 2001.
Why did you choose to leave the islands? Do you remember?
My son was 3, and we wanted him to have a chance to experience New York City. And my husband had a thriving massage therapy business in the city. My friends and my colleagues from Fordham Law School and Harvard and New York City were anxious to have us come back and sort of resettle into the energy of the city, and I would either be teaching or writing. And Clay would have a chance, my son would have a chance to experience Manhattan with, someone who is truly a Manhattanite. I had spent most of my adult life in the city. So Manhattan is a small town to me. I feel very comfortable and happy there, even through the changes that it's gone through, some fairly catastrophic changes. I love the city. I feel at home there. I haven't felt that way anywhere else in the world except Delhi, India. I had a similar experience when I was in Delhi. I was there for four visits, and I had the same kind of expansive, joyous experience of the city.
Yeah, I grew up in the city, and I'm very comfortable there, and I worked for years on Wall Street, and I went back and forth, and I know the area and the East Side fairly well. You came back to New York in May 2001, and you're really just getting settled when 9/11 hit. And I know you became very involved in the healing process. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we had just pretty much unpacked our boxes on the Upper West Side. We wanted to be near the park for Clay. My son spent a lot of time in the park with our 2 golden retrievers, and we just thought it was a good place. I'd lived on the Upper West Side for many years on and off during my time in Manhattan, so I felt comfortable there. But when the towers went down, when 9/11 happened, I had worked at Windows on the World for several different times, but once for a month as a young temp typist. And I remember seeing the views every day from Windows on the World and just feeling that it was such a magical experience, magical place. And to see the towers go down, and I lost 5 friends that day, a childhood friend from junior high school, 2 co-workers, 2 friends from law school. It was a devastating time for the city. And in some senses, I really think I'm still going through the grief process.
You mentioned to me that you also set up some healing programs and trying to bring some relief to some of the people in New York. Tell us about that.
Well, we had just come back from the islands, and one of the interesting sort of cultural expressions of grief and remembrance in Hawaii is when someone dies, their family and friends will gather at a beach and paddle out. It's called a paddle out. They'll go out on surfboards or kayaks or any kind of longboard or little boats out into the water in a circle, and they will release flowered lei, the necklaces, into the water, and they'll talk about the person and remember them and chant in Hawaiian. It's a very beautiful, peaceful, gentle ceremony. When the towers went down and New York was in complete chaos and we were teary-eyed and feeling that there was nothing we could do, we felt really impotent. I said to my husband and my friends, we should arrange a paddle out for New York City for everyone who's been touched, who's had a friend or a relative who died, and say goodbye. And the idea just sort of blossomed, and within 2 days I had reached out to Fordham Law School, and they agreed to give me access to the law school the night before the ceremony. I named it the New York Aloha Memorial Ceremony. And I reached out to all of my friends on the East Coast and in Hawaii who were paddlers or water sports people, anyone who had any relatives who had been in the city who had been touched by this horrible tragedy, who could come and go out into the river, the Hudson River on the west side, and do a paddle out. I didn't know how I was going to get enough lay. So I reached out to two of the top floral suppliers in New York City down in the 20s on the west side, and they donated 10,000 carnations. We picked up these boxes in trucks and took them back to Fordham Law School, where 150 of my friends, classmates, paddlers, people who were from Hawaii, law school students, sat for 8 hours and strung together these beautiful flower lays. All the lays were transported to the pier on the west side, and the next day the ceremony sort of just beautifully, organically unfolded. We had dancers from Hawaii who came and danced the ancient kahiko hula, very sad, beautiful mourning dances. And then paddlers and surfers and kayakers, they all went into the water. 150 people went out into the water and released 10,000 beautiful flower lays into the water. And it was recorded. Several documentarians filmed it that year, and I repeated the ceremony 2 more years, consecutive years in a row, and several documentaries that were talking about the healing of Ground Zero featured the ceremony and came and filmed us, including film crews from Hawaii, and we were the lead story on the 6 o'clock news in Hawaii the second year that the ceremony occurred. There's 1,000 people attended each time. It was very moving, very beautiful, and it's a very special, poignant time in my life. I'm very glad I had the chance to do that.
After moving to Putnam Valley, New York, and as that's in my general area, as people in the audience might know, did you turn your activity to fiction writing, beginning with the novel with the 9/11 backdrop? Why still another change in direction?
About 3 weeks after the towers went down, I was in New York. I was getting ready to do the ceremony, and I was looking at the newspaper. I don't know if you remember back then, but they started putting notices in the paper called Portraits of Grief. They would do a small write-up and a picture of each of the 2,800 people who died. So I was reading the Portraits of Grief and other news stories, and I remember seeing a very small news story that a woman had fallen in the chaos of the towers going down. She'd been injured, but mostly it was a head injury, and she was life-flighted to a New Jersey hospital. When she woke up, she couldn't remember her name. She had no identification, and they didn't know really how to find her family. It was, I don't know if you remember New York City at the time, but it was complete chaos. You couldn't get below 14th Street, and then they moved the line, so you couldn't get below Canal Street. You couldn't travel in the city. It was very tight security everywhere. But I read the story of this woman who had been essentially missing from her life. And it was weeks later that a family member happened to see a picture of her, and they thought she had perished in the towers. And they went to New Jersey, and it was this big reunion, and it was sort of a miracle. But I found out later that there are actually many of those stories where people were essentially gone missing. They went missing, and it wasn't until 2 days or a week or 2 weeks later that they were able to reconnect with their families. And something just clicked, and I started writing sort of sketching out a story. I eventually wrote it as a novel, and I had a few friends who were literary types, and they read it and said, you might have something here. Maybe you should query some agents and see what they say. And I ended up having several offers to have my novel represented, and I signed with an agent in New York City.
You've now completed 2 novels, and you're looking for publishers. How is that coming?
My current novel, called Inauspicious, was my second attempt at doing sort of a creative retelling of an actual person's life. In 1987, a young girl named Roop Kenwar who lived in Rajasthan, India. She was 19 years old. She was married, newlywed. Her husband was 20 years old, and he died mysteriously. In India, if your husband predeceases you, regardless of your caste or your economic strata or your education level, you're considered an inauspicious person. You're unlucky. And women have very few choices once they become widows. Sati, which is the burning of the bride or the wife on the pyre of the husband who has died, had been outlawed in the 1800s by the English when they were in control of India. But it was still a practice that was ongoing, especially in the very rural areas in the north and some areas in the south. So if a woman is unfortunate enough to have her husband die in India, even today, she is considered very much an outsider, even if she had done everything right up until that point. She still looked askance. And this young girl, Roop Kanwar, she was drugged by her in-laws and thrown on the pyre and burned alive. The news went up across India, and the fundamentalists were enraged that anyone was trying to denigrate the practice. They believed that if a woman wanted to jump on the pyre of her husband and die with him, that they should be allowed to do that and encouraged to do that, because it would bring acclaim to their family and to their town, because they would become goddesses. This goes very far back. This is in the Vedas. Thousands of years ago, these stories were written. Unfortunately, this young woman died, but the town that she perished in is a very tiny town in Rajasthan. And I had written a paper when I was at Harvard on Sati. And when I read about her story in 1987, it stayed with me, and I thought, someday I need to write about this. After Gone Missing went through a round of publishers, and they praised the writing but thought that using 9/11 as a set piece was too early in publishing, I was encouraged to write another novel. So I wrote Inauspicious. And I wanted to know more about this girl, this actual woman who was murdered. My baby sister passed away tragically, and she left a small bit of money to me. And I used the money, and I flew to India, and I spent a month there, including time actually in the very town where Roop had been murdered, interviewing her family and friends and trying to find out what really happened. I'd been studying Hinduism for a long time, and I had been studying Hindi for over a year. I felt comfortable in India. I really enjoyed my time there, and I knew absolutely when I came back that I had to finish writing the story of this young girl and fictionalize it. And I sent it out to some new agents, and I currently have an agent in New York City who is now shopping Inauspicious. There's a film company on the West Coast that is reading it as a possible television made for TV movie, which would be great. And I look forward to moving the project forward either as a novel in print or as a film.
You mentioned both your travels to India and your life in Hawaii. Can you put a finger on how much these very, very different from our ways of life have possibly changed your perspective on life in general?
Hawaii had been the childhood dream, and the beauty of the place certainly inspired me to think deeply about my connection to the water because of the oceans and the beauty of the oceans there. It gave me a lot of time to spend in nature with my child, who was learning how to walk and then swim and then run and play. He's certainly a child of the islands. Being in India was an extremely different experience because I was definitely on a mission when I was there. While I was there, I also had the chance to stay at the Dalai Lama's guest house in Dharamsala, India. And as a student of Buddhism for almost 35 years, it was sort of like my Mecca or Israel for people who celebrate Islam and Judeo-Christianity. So going to India, spending time with people who have very, very little, who seem very willing to learn from others, but grounded in very ancient beliefs, made it possible for me to have a different perspective on my life, being much more grateful for the very, very small things. Spending time in Delhi, which is the capital of the subcontinent, and experiencing the very regular and expected power outages throughout the city was daunting. I came back to the States thinking, how would it be if the electricity went out every day for many hours in Washington, D.C.? When I teach my students now, I remark to them that we're so fortunate to have running water and electricity. We take things for granted, having water. Many of the women that I spent time with in Rajasthan walked 7 or 8 miles a day with water on their heads and babies strapped on their hips because they didn't have water nearby. They had to walk for their water. So my awareness of the world around me, my appreciation for the gifts that I've been given, access to education and clean water, and not living in a war zone, not being afraid to leave my home, and awareness of the plight of children, the fact that they are not being educated. Only 37% of the women in Rajasthan are educated and can read at any level. It was daunting to see how much work can and needs to be done. But the people were so embracive. India was beautifully loving to me. She gave me everything that I needed on my trip, and I believe that inauspicious is I'm hoping that it's a fair and generous reflection of my time there.
After the end of your 16-year marriage, you went and still in another direction, teaching as an adjunct professor first at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, where, as I mentioned, I had a long-term relationship. I still do. And then also at Dutchess Community College and the Carleen Institute of America. You teach a wide range of courses, introduction to philosophy, world religions, worldviews and values, ethics, the literature and gender, short fiction, American short fiction, English literature, introduction to writing and familiar writing. Why did you go in that direction instead of hanging out the Lord Shingle? Are you a member of the New York State Bar?
No, I'm not. And one of the things I learned spending time as a future district attorney and as a clerk for Judge Berkman was that the information and the learning that I did at law school was key in my understanding of my position in the world and very much so women's positions. But I felt that my life would be too narrowly skewed were I to practice law only. And I knew that if I were to do it well, I would need to devote a lot of time and effort to that end. And I had a small child at the time, so the designation of the hours simply every day was not going to allow me to be as invested as I knew I wanted to be in law. But when my marriage ended, I knew that I needed to do something as a single mom to not only bring an income, but to expand my sort of circle of influence and colleagues. A dear friend of mine was teaching at Marist, and she recommended that I contact someone, and she served as a liaison, and I got hired to teach a couple of classes, philosophy and ethics, world religions, and it just was a perfect click for me. I'd been teaching any number of things since I was 13 years old, dancing, fitness. I taught Bible studies when I was younger, when I was a member of the Methodist Church out on Long Island. I taught fitness and weight training, all the physical realm activities. But I finally felt that I had a chance to stretch my intellectual and my academic skill set by putting into good use the information and the questions that I had about these different topics and encourage my students on this journey with me. And it's been a really excellent fit. I'm extremely excited every time I step into my classroom. I try to bring a sense of humor and a sense of purpose when I'm teaching. But because I love the topics that I'm teaching and I respect the students for showing up and bringing their energy and their curiosity, it's surely the central joy of my life at this point is to teach. I teach at three different, very different colleges, and the three student bodies that I teach are very different, and I am more amazed every day at how much I'm learning from my students. My Marist students, by and large, are sort of typical upper class, upper middle class students who are at a four-year private college, and they have definitely, they're coming to the school experience, their schooling experience, with certain skill sets, certain abilities. That many of them have traveled. Some of them have other languages. When I teach at Dutchess Community College, it's a two-year school, and it's meant to help students prepare for them to do a four-year degree if they choose to. But many of them are really just getting started or were like me, had not done extremely well in their first year or so in college and really needed help, remedial help. Then when I teach at the Culinary Institute, my students have to take writing classes in order for them to pass out into their professional careers as either bakers or chefs. And I've been given many classes there where I have only bakers and then only chefs, and they're very different personality types. Fascinating, I was told by the dean that you'll notice that the chefs have a certain energy and personality, and that the bakers do too, and sure enough, they do. All of my students across the board in all three schools give me the chance to bring to bear some of the strong lessons that I learned from my really good teachers, which mostly centered around listening, bringing good energy into the classroom, and making the contract and the promise to do my best, and they do their best. So far, it's been a very good mix. This is my fourth year teaching. I've added a few new courses to my my dossier. I really enjoyed teaching English literature from 1660 until 1900. I get to stretch some of my literature chops, and it's always lovely to be completely intimidated by some of the famous writers that I have to impart to my students. But it's definitely a wonderful feeling in my classroom when my students have their light bulb moments. I really do live for that.
Yeah, I do too, and it's when the light goes on, it's terrific. But when I was teaching at Monroe for a while, I had some people in the cooking school, and some of them resented having to take courses other than what they're preparing for, English or introduction to computers, which are all required. There was not this interest. There was one of these things, I have to go through this. Have you found that at CIA at all?
Yes, actually, I found it at all of my schools. At Marist, the students are required to take philosophy, but they're also required to take ethics, which I think is fantastic. To learn why people do what they do and how different people's perspectives are culturally around the world, I tell my students when I'm teaching my ethics classes, which is sort of my bailiwick from my Harvard experience, that we have to learn how to play nice in this big sandbox, you know, of our world. We won't get very far if we're just trying to hurt each other or take advantage of each other. My students at Culinary, when they walk in and they have to take this mandatory writing class, I often see them coming in with not a lot of energy and not a lot of interest. They're just going to try to get through it. One of them actually said, you know, I'm going to be a famous chef, so I don't really need this. That was my first day at Culinary, and I thought, you know what, I really need to address this. I spent the rest of the semester helping them to understand that whether it's an email to a future employer, a letter to a bank officer to get money to fund a cooking show that they want to do, letters that they're going to write to potential investors or partners, they're going to need to be able to wrangle the language. And when I made it practical for them, my culinary students lit up. I learned how to teach to my audiences, and my students teach me more every day, but I think I'm getting the hang of this.
I know that you've also developed poster presentations for the Northeastern Evolutionary Psychology Society on subjects that seem a little far from your field. What's that all about?
I have several close friends who are psychology students. They're doing graduate programs in psychology. And every time we've had a chance to talk about psychology, sort of the why, the science behind why people make the decisions that they do, one of the things that we all agree on is that if we can figure out the reasons behind what we do, it might give us clues as to how to work better in groups, how to understand each other's motivations, and maybe improve the processes along the way to facilitate other people learning and to maximize the benefits for everyone involved. So along the way, the last couple of years, I had the chance to meet several people who were participating in the evolutionary psychology field. I've been doing some reading as well. Very interested in the conflation of neuroscience and philosophy. I've been reading Sam Harris, who's a neuroscientist. He's been writing from his perspective as a neuroscientist, as a brain expert, but also on philosophy and why we end up thinking the way we do, the choices that we make. And I was inspired by Sam. I often spend at least an hour or so in my ethics and philosophy classes playing different YouTubes of him speaking about this, trying to incorporate our understanding of human development over the course of our evolution as to understand why we make the choices that we do and what we actually can attribute to our understandings of free will. Because ethics, when we're talking about choices, do we really have choices if we've been only subjected or experiencing certain things as young children or young people? Do we really have choices to have different behaviors? I met several people at the NEEPS conference in Pennsylvania several years ago who were interested in working with me as a philosopher and an ethicist to bridge the understanding of psychology and morality. And I've been able to work closely with Dr. Killian Garvey, who's at the University of Louisiana. And he and I did some work together about morality, different populations, pathogen prevalence, how it might affect the actual choices that people make if they're physically well. It's been a really interesting developmental experience for me, and I'm going to be doing some more writing with not only Dr. Garvey, but I'm hoping to write with some other psychologists and bridge the understandings between science and philosophy. I think that is a way forward, and I'm looking forward to participating as much as I can.
Do you mention Sam Harris? He's also well known for his writings on religion, or the absence of religion. He with a number of other people have considered the prominent, say, aggressive atheists in the world. But I remember someone reading one of his first books, as I did, who felt that his approach to life was almost a Buddhist approach. From you teaching various courses in religion, what do you have to say about that aspect of Harris's writing?
Well, it's interesting. I have three books on my shelf next to my bed right now, and one of them is Sam's most recent book called Waking Up. He's been one of the people that has been really pulling in some of the things that I found that were interesting. When I teach my philosophy classes, I start with Confucius thought and I move all the way through Darwin. When we get to Hinduism and Buddhism, I take my students to this very, very beautiful atrium on Marist campus, and I have them do a 15-minute seated silent meditation where they literally are just sitting for 15 minutes and breathing, and I don't really guide them. 99% of them have never had that kind of experience before. And then I ask them, too, if they want extra credit, they can write about their experience, in my eyes only. And the responses I've gotten for the last 4 years from that simple exercise has been staggering, and it has been backed up time and again by not just Sam's work, but many other people's work about the benefits of meditation, irregardless of religion, anybody's cultural referencing, the exercise of sitting silently and breathing for even 5 minutes. We are finding the scientists are doing these amazing studies with monks and nuns in the Zen and the Buddhist traditions. Very healing, and also avenues toward personal growth and development that my students experienced from only one 15-minute seated meditation. So I thought, there's got to be a way to incorporate this quiet, still time for especially young teenagers as they're, you know, embarking on their academic careers, to find a way to heal from the chaos of their days, to take a time out from their electronic devices and their media addictions. And every time I do the class and every time we do the meditation, my students universally respond in their writings that it has been the most quiet, positive, healing moment that they had had in years. Many of them said that they continue to do the 5 minutes a day or 10 minutes a day on their own. They're healing. Their headaches are going away. Their missing home has been dissipating. They're studying better, and they're passing their exams. They're remembering things in class. This has been all backed up in the last 15, 20 years by the science of meditation. But Sam's work, especially in his recent book, Waking Up, is really owing to sort of the miraculous benefits of meditation. And I've been meditating since I was young. I say that I'm still a student because every time you sit, it's different. Every time I sit, it's certainly different. But that's when I see the light bulb moments from my students, and when I hear the responses later that it was an absolute sea change for many of my students. I believe that there's something very special and important about that.
After the many turns in your life's career path, what's next for Renee Del Kay Esterbrooks?
So you want to know what the K means, right, John?
I will get to that. But what does the K mean? As long as it is?
The K, when I moved to Hawaii and I had my son, right before I had my son, my husband and I knew a kahuna there, a famous mystical man, is called a kahuna. Large, huge man, Portuguese kahuna. And he would do the blessings for the canoe paddlers and do the blessings and weddings, very much a Hawaiian mystical man, very well respected. And he gave me a Hawaiian name, which is something I really always dreamed that someone would give me a Hawaiian name because they're very beautiful. So he gave me a name beginning with K. It's called Ke Aloha Pau'ole, and it means love never ending. So he said, as long as I'm writing about anything that has to do with Hawaii or my experience of Hawaii, that I need to use my name to satisfy the gods and goddesses, especially Pele, who's the goddess down in Ka'u in the big island of Hawaii in the lava. So I said I would use his the name that he gave me, and I really love having that name. It means a lot to me. What's next is I'm going to be writing, doing more writing and more collaborating with other psychologists and philosophers, hopefully, sort of bringing to bear my interest in ethics and world religions. I work with women, and I want to continue working with the demographic of survivors of sexual and domestic violence, helping them with healing. I want to continue teaching. And I'm going to hopefully be writing a book on everyday ethics for young people. My agent has urged me to do that as my next project, so I'll be moving from fiction into nonfiction. There are no primers, I tell my students, on how to live this life, but I'm hoping that maybe I can shed some light on some of the ideas that helped me as a young person and that I see reflected in my students today.
Now, when you mention working with women who have been the victims of violence, we haven't really gotten into that. What do you do with these people, and how do you do it?
Many, many years ago, I had several very difficult experiences in surviving acts of violence, and at the time, there were very few women, if not any women, involved in either law enforcement or in the healing arts. So I had to sort of go it alone, try to get over some of the things that had happened to me. Along the way, I met other women who had similar experiences, but I've been really encouraged and impressed by different women's groups, especially local women's groups in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, some of the places I worked with, groups in Hawaii and Ohio, who have been working with women not just only in their trauma moments when they're actually trying to flee domestic violence or sexual violence or post-sexual assault, but also down the line helping women sort of reintegrate into their lives, move and relocate to safe locations, gain a footing in their work life, and also encourage them to continue their education. I work with women at all stages of their trauma, whether it's, you know, just moments after they've been hurt and they either reach out to me through a reference or a friend or family member, or down the line where women have been working with other groups such as My Sister's Place, Vogue Friends. There are a number of amazing opportunities for women who want to help other women in law and in social sciences and social work. But my main goal has been always to be a one-on-one counselor. Women, especially my young students, come to me often with problems that they don't feel they can tell their parents, or they feel uncomfortable telling their RAs or their dorm directors or even their friends. And hopefully I can send them on the right path, places that they can go to get help, extra counseling, physical rehabilitation, and places where they can write, different poetry slams that they can read their poetry if they want to express themselves. Some of the women decide that they want to do this kind of work themselves, and I refer them to excellent master's programs around the country.
Most of our discussion's been with your moving from college dropout up through all sorts of things that took you to where you are now. It's a very positive movement, but you just mentioned that you had some rough times. Now, one time you actually mentioned homelessness. How did that happen, and how did you get out of it?
When I moved into the city, there were several, you know, strange and unfortunate interactions with people that I trusted and then ended up not feeling safe with. So I left a place that I was living and could not find a place to live in time. So I slept in Penn Station. I was waiting for my money to come in from a temp job that I had taken. So I was working for several weeks before I got a paycheck. So I was literally living sort of coffee cart to coffee cart every day at the place that I was temping, and at night I would go to Penn Station and sleep there, wash up in the washroom, knowing that, you know, hopefully in a couple of weeks I would get my money and I would have sort of a normal life. I ended up living at the YWCA on Lexington Avenue in the 50s, renting a tiny little room there for $25 a night, and it really felt like a palace after having not had a place to sleep at night. So coming from such a humble place and seeing how tough it is to be out on the street and meeting other women and men who had bad runs on their luck makes me very much appreciate all my gifts and sort of my standard of living now. Spending time in India, seeing people who are really struggling, five or six families in one apartment or one building. One of the things I try to impress upon my students, especially the students who come from wealthier families, is to really appreciate what they have and consider giving back and consider helping other people who are not as well situated. It's all about perspective. I felt really lucky that I survived and that I've gotten as far as I have. Many people have helped me along the way. Good Samaritans seemingly on every corner. And I really felt that if I could get through it, that it was my job to give back. So I've been working pro bono for about 20 years. I never charge for my advice or my counseling to survivors and to young women. I give it away and hope that someday they feel strong enough that they can also help out.
Another coincidence, I took the great darkroom course at that very Y years ago from a professional photographer named Casey
Yes.
Allen.
Two years
later, I wound up teaching at a course at NYU about technology. It was also diagonally across the street from what was then Manny Wolf's, that became Smith and Belinsky, where my wife and I have had some of the best steaks we've ever had in New York City. We've covered a whole lot of ground, detailing the many aspects of your interesting life. Is there anything that we haven't touched that you'd like the audience to know about Rani Estabrook?
When I was 12 years old, seventh grade, a very brave teacher in my junior high school brought in a little film for us to watch. It was called Meet. It was an underground black and white film on a whistleblower in the meat industry who was seeing really bad behavior, devastating things, and cruelty in the meat industry. And I remember that day very clearly. That was the last day I had red meat. I haven't had red meat since I was 12 years old. Over the course of my life, my choice of being a vegetarian, I actually do have dairy, but I will only eat organic products. It's been a very interesting experience because when I was first practicing not eating meat, it wasn't that popular. I actually took some heat from family and friends about this decision. Initially, it was sort of a moral, ethical decision on my part, but since then, being a fitness person and a physical trainer, I learned that, for me anyway, the best diet and the best food for me as an athlete was fresh vegetables, fruits, and grains. When I was in India, I was in heaven, especially where I was in Rajasthan and northern India, because most of the places that I was visiting were vegetarian, and I had the best curries in the world and the most delicious food. And for a vegetarian, it was truly heaven. So people ask me how I stay healthy and how I stay positive. I think one of the reasons that I've been able to stay healthy is and fit and positive as long as I have is because I do spend quite a bit of mental time considering how I'm going to fuel my body. And I really love cooking. So when I went to the Culinary Institute to teach, I was also in heaven. I got to see amazing chefs and bakers working in those beautiful ovens and kitchens. And my culinary students teach me quite a lot about cooking techniques, which I have been trying to implore. I love to cook. Cooking is a passion. I have an organic garden, a large organic garden that I grow vegetables in every summer. I can feed my family, and it's a source of zen. I get a chance to meditate and spend time with things that are growing, and then I get to use them in delicious food. So it's one of my not-so-secret passions, and I really love to cook, and I love serving large groups, throwing parties, and seeing people eat and enjoy.
Shall I take back the comments I made about the steaks of the Smith & Wollensky's?
I am more than happy to cook meat for other people. I just don't eat it. My son is a teenager, and he eats meat, and I prepare food for him, and he likes it. It's just not my choice to consume it.
Thank you very much, Renee. It's been a real pleasure.
John, it was a delight. Thank you so much for having me.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, historian Daniel Pipes, and Professor Oren Lehman-Walden. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at open.salon.com/blog/JohnMack13. This blog, by the way, is available automatically on Kindles for the exorbitant cost of 99 cents per month. Renee didn't know that. And those who sign up right away will have the link to this show permanently on the Kindles. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Met Radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, johnmack13, for the URLs of previous shows. Tune in next week to him, my conversation with Wendy Bounds, author of the wonderful Little Chapel by the River. And until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And tonight, instead of going out with the Lone Ranger, I'm going to go out with the Basie Band. Hope you had a good time.
I had a good time.
Ba 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 ba